sovereign nature. It had a self-sustaining quality. We get the best baseball players, some of the best food, best music, free education, free health care. They're trying to create a model, and I think that they do matter, especially now that immigrant rights is so important in this country. We're becoming more Latinoized, as I think you yourself have written, and we're changing. And Cuba can be very, very central to making us understand ourselves as living in the Americas. This is our home region. And we should be welcoming of honest, open relations with Cuba and other countries in the hemisphere.
Tom Hayden, I want to thank you for being with us. We're going to talk about the 50th anniversary of the first anti-Vietnam War teach-in, 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, and put it online at democracynow.org. Tom Hayden is the author of, well, his latest book is Listen, Yankee, Why Cuba Matters, part of, based on conversations with Ricardo Alarcón, the former Cuban foreign minister. Tom will be speaking at a major conference in Washington, D.C. this Friday and Saturday at New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, not to be confused with New York. It's in D.C. I'm there. Juan Gonzalez will be there. Love to see you there. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio with host Joanne Hardesty. Today's guests are David Dahl, the owner of Dave's Killer Bread, and some representatives from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We'll talk about the upcoming 5K walk.
You can help KBOO end the spring membership drive early. Donate right now and be entered into the Spring Membership Drive sweepstakes. One lucky KBOO supporter will win a prize package that includes a six-month VIP pass to the Crystal Ballroom that allows you and a guest entry to every show, even if it's sold out, as well as access to the VIP viewing area. A one-week artist residency at Southwestern Lodge in Seaview, Washington on the Long Beach Peninsula, $200 in gift certificates to the Portland Saturday Market, and 10 treatments at Working Class Acupuncture. For every $15,000 we raise between now and May 5th, we will remove one day from the Spring Membership Drive, which will be from May 6th through May 16th. Thank you for your early support. All the funds raised during this time will be applied to the Spring Membership Drive goal of $95,000. A donation is not required to enter the sweepstakes. For more info, kboo.fm/2015springsweeps.
Hi, this is Sun Lee, KBOO's membership director. I want to thank you for being a member and a listener to KBOO. Also wanted to share this listener's comment on why they support KBOO.
This last year has been my first year listening to KBOO and will be a listener for years to come. I enjoy the Saturday morning programs with bluegrass folk and the Grateful Dead. It's really nice to listen to the music that is new to me and off the grid. Other radio stations get very repetitive and boring, and that's why I love KBOO. The programs are invigorating and make me smile. Noelle, a new member from Portland, Oregon.
We hope that you feel the same. Please support your community and your local radio station by going to kboo.fm/give.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Volunteers of America, Oregon, presenting a symposium on diversity, equity, and economic sustainability May 8th at the Childs Center. Keynote speaker, Stedman Graham. Tickets and information at volunteersofamericaoregon.org.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up. Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. It is my pleasure to have a fabulous program for you today. I'm going to introduce you to my three guests who are here in the studio with me, and then we're just going to jump into the conversation. And our conversation today will be about the 13th Annual NAMI Walk, which will take place on Sunday, May 17th. We will give you all the details. You won't have to go anywhere. And actually, the details are already on my Facebook page and also on KBOO's website. So my first guest is Michelle Madison, and she has worked at NAMI Oregon since 2008. She's lived in seven different states in Mexico and has previously worked as a reporter and editor for mainstream and alternative media. I bet we could talk. Writing extensively about feminism, poverty, and social justice issues. She grew up in a household where she and her siblings were encouraged to advocate and make noise, and is a passionate advocate on behalf of people living with mental illness and their family members and loved ones. Next in the studio is a longtime friend of mine and also a community advocate for NAMI Walk, and she's a professional pet and house sitter. She has gathered armfuls of inspiring stories of how people manage to get through their day with a little help from their pets. Rolling over to happiness, she is referred to as infectious enthusiasm, oh yeah, and has found a pile of laughter in being one with an animal. And I'll also say that her personal experience has been she has a sister who's lived with mental health issues, and she has been her advocate as well as advocates for others. And last but not least, my guest who isn't here yet, but he's on his way because the traffic this morning is just absolutely insane. And you're going to love this guest. The gentleman that I am referring to is David Dahl. And you may know him from his famous Dave's Killer Bread. He will be here in the studio with us this morning as well. And I will give you a little bit about his introduction. I think, of course, most people know Dave Dahl because of the killer bread. And when I say killer, I mean it's good bread. But here's the bio that he sent me, and I was so touched by it. I didn't change a word. I just thought I would read it as it was presented. He says, I am a well-known baker with lifetime depression issues, formerly self-medicated with methamphetamines, resulting in four prison stints before discovering Palix, then Ephor, which made it possible for me to focus on doing good things like making bread. After 8.5 years of working hard to build a brand, which includes speaking to many thousands of people about my transformation, I had my first bipolar episode on November 14th, 2013. That this was covered heavily in the news. There's a lot that hasn't been told, and there's a lot of misinformation about this incident. After being diagnosed as bipolar for the first time after the incident, I started taking proper meds and began to understand what the term meant and how to avoid a psychic manic episode ever again. That terrible night was almost unbearably painful in a number of ways. The actual experience of quote-unquote losing my mind, as well as the resulting stress my company experienced, which in itself was a great weight on my shoulders, not to mention the devastation of letting down so many who believed in me, created my greatest adversary to date, adversity to date. But out of the ashes rises the phoenix once again. Mm-hmm. Before the incident, I had felt that I had a reason to tell my story. And now, I think my vision and my mission are even more powerful for helping others deal with their own mental illness. And I think my purpose in life goes beyond helping those with mental illness. Everyone can benefit from an inspirational story, including me. So as I've done before the 2013 incident, I support NAMI to help reduce mental illness stigma, inspire others to admit their pain and get help, and even to advocate to better training of police with regard to mentally ill. Psychosis doesn't make you a criminal and should be dealt with accordingly. Wow. Whoa. What a bio, huh? And so I just can't wait for him to join us. But we're going to start the conversation, which is perfect because I think we'll get to talk about NAMI, the walk, and why this is so important. And so, Michelle, I will turn to you. You are the director of the walk. Is that correct?
I'm the outreach and events manager at NAMI.
Outreach and events manager. Okay. And the walk falls under that.
It does.
Tell us about the walk. It's going to happen on Sunday, May 17th.
This is the largest mental health event in Oregon. We had about 4,000 people there last year from all over the state. Some as far as Bend came here and some from Southwest Washington. And it is a big fundraiser for us because we don't charge for services. But equally important is that we're going out and saying, you know, hey, we're those of us living with mental illness, and that includes myself, we are part of the community. We're no one to be afraid of. We deserve dignity and respect. And basically trying to make a statement that mental health matters because unlike any other chronic illness, this is something, you know, it's not going to come up in conversation necessarily. If you have a relative that, you know, got diagnosed with diabetes or cancer and they were in treatment, you probably wouldn't think twice about sharing that with a friend or a coworker. Whereas, you know, my Monday morning, you know, people aren't usually going to come into the office at like somewhere that wasn't NAMI and say, hey, my brother had a psychotic break over the weekend. Yeah, it's been kind of a rough time. And it shouldn't be different. Mm-hmm. You know, 1 in 4 adults lives with mental illness, 1 in 10 children. But this is still something that people, they whisper about or they're afraid to talk about. And when people are afraid to talk, they are often afraid to get help. And just like any other illness, the longer you wait to get treatment, the worse it can get.
Absolutely true. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And so, Michelle, what led you to NAMI as a career?
I was a reporter, and I felt like I was covering social services and social justice issues, and I felt like I actually wanted to go out and just advocate rather than just write about it. And so I kind of came into NAMI as an accident. I had a good feeling about the job, and it was actually the first time that I was really able to confront what was going on with my family, because I have a grandmother with type 1 bipolar disorder who wasn't diagnosed until her 50s. And so when my mother and her siblings were growing up, she was constantly hospitalized. She had breaks, and then when I was little, she would just disappear for months at a time. And my family never told us what was going on because they were embarrassed. They would say, oh, Tootie fell down the stairs again. And, you know, by the time I was in junior high, I'm like, there's something else going on here.
She falls a lot.
Yeah, I think it'd be in the handrail or, you know, and just realizing as an adult, you know, and I had started to have depression issues in high school, really bad depression. And at the time, it wasn't thought that teenagers could have mental illness. So mm-hmm. I felt like, okay, what's wrong with me? My parents didn't know what to do. You know, and had I grown up and heard, okay, my grandmother's having a problem in her brain. It's just like if she broke her arm, she's just, you know, going to go get treatment for it. That really would have helped me. And it would have helped me help other people sooner.
Mm-hmm. And then I bet as a child, you were feeling like this sense of, you know, you weren't sure whether she was ever coming back, right? Because she kept coming and going. And
it was scary, you know, and what they would always say is, oh, Tootie fell and hit her head. So it's like somehow it's connected to her brain, but I have no idea what's going on, you mm-hmm. know. And then when I find out, you know, as a teenager, you know, she's had EC treatment, she's been hospitalized, and this is obviously, you know, what was sent home to me is this is something that, you know, my mother's family is ashamed about. This mm-hmm. is something that we don't talk about. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very toxic. And unfortunately, I think there are a lot of people that still think of mental illness that way, that somehow it's someone's fault.
Right, right. And Wendy, tell us about you. How did you get connected to NAMI?
Well, I was fortunate enough to read about the Family to Family class, and all of NAMI's classes and offerings are free. They really want to make sure that the community knows everything's open, and they just offer so many resources. It's amazing. Just go to the website. But I took the Family to Family class, which was very intense. It's 3 hours a night for 12 weeks. I met 28 other families that were very struck by mental health issues in their family. Some, you know, we would cry weekly, mm-hmm. and it was very difficult. I'm fortunate. My sister just turned 62. She's made it without medication. She lives up in a remote community, so that that's helpful, and she stocks shelves at night so that she doesn't have to interact on a daily basis with a world that's way overloading for her. Mm-hmm. So it was very helpful to me. I feel very fortunate because obviously we all know that these dynamics occur in families repetitively. And so I feel like the NAMI community is so accepting, loving, a safe place for anything that happens. And when I was in real jobs, it was, again, not accepted to have a hard day because my sister was, you know, going to be evicted or, you know, something significant, which was going to roll things into a pretty, you know, disastrous situation. So I feel very fortunate that I'm involved with NAMI and I have a safe place to go. And I want to say to Pam Dunham, my instructor, who I'm still in touch with and is just a fabulous trainer and teacher with NAMI, is also doing some additional training. We're, you know, NAMI's out in the community all the time trying to find ways to educate teachers or counselors or police officers or other people that are interfacing with these circumstances that you just need to understand them.
Absolutely true. We have several callers on the line, so we're going to go to the phone line. Good morning, Joanne. Welcome to KBOO.
Oh, it's so hard for me to talk because this opens a Pandora's box. Oh, so many heavy things. But anyway, I'm going to try. First of all, the ability to cry because of the culture I live in has been killed in me. Second, I've been trying to teach my daughter and children not to be ashamed. Oh, I'm going to start to cry. Not to be ashamed to be disabled or low income, but I'm not reaching them. But, I just want to say one more thing and leave. I realize this is a heavy program and you have a focus, but I guess because I'm old and low income, I've been wondering whether, and probably nobody knows with everything else going on, whether elderly people being secretly electroshock in nursing homes and that. But anyway, thank you very much for the program and for listening. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanne. We always appreciate your call. I have not heard of any cases locally of elderly people being shocked in nursing homes or care facilities. I don't think that that's a part of care today. If someone knows differently, then call and let us know. But Joanne, there's no shame in being low income. There's no shame in having mental or physical illnesses. Hopefully you'll keep listening and realize that that's one part of our job today is actually to remove that stigma, to remove that shame, to remove that uncomfortableness, to talk about our health. I mean, we talk about a community's health, and a community's health depends on the mental health of the people in the community. So, and all of us, I heard a statistic that all of us move in and out of being mentally okay. And, you know, for some of us, you know, we have days that we're down. Some of us, it goes on a lot longer. And just understanding that that spectrum is important. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of other callers on the line. Good morning, Mike. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning, Joanne. First of all, I want to say that society is broken into two categories. You got your neurotics and you got your psychotics. And the devastating part about this is you got the neurotic people trying to fix the problem of the people that is classified neurotics. And so it ain't going to work. Like you said, we all got issues. And in this society, this capitalistic society, I have a question. Do mental illness runs in the police department? Because I find that anybody that can have a job that will cause you to kill somebody and you walk away from that experience and, you know, you're okay or you're all right, you get medals, you get commendations, I think that's a form of illness. But nobody talks about that. Anyway, I got a brother who's in the mental illness system, and they run it like a prison. And he's in a locked facility. He hasn't been classified as criminally insane. He wasn't put there for committing any crimes. He was put there because they say he couldn't take care of himself. Yet, they run it like a prison. Hmm. And so, anyway, I just wanted to throw that out. you know, like I said, psychotics and neurotics. It's only two categories of people in this society.
So, anyway, Mike, I love when you call, because I normally only agree with half of what you say. But the part about police and mental illness, I'm with you on that. So I appreciate you calling us today. Have a good day. But, you know, he raises a point. He's got a brother who is in a locked facility, not because he committed a crime, not because he was a danger to the community, but because somebody made a decision that he couldn't take care of himself. Is that a story that you hear regularly at NAMI?
excuse me. That's civil commitment is a really hot button issue at this point, but it's not a story we hear regularly. We do hear from people who feel like they don't know how to help their loved one, mm-hmm. really. And there's that very fine line, because the criteria for civil commitment are so narrow. You have to be considered in Oregon an immediate threat to yourself or somebody else. And really, until then, it's very hard to get into treatment. Mm-hmm. And unlike any other, you know, physical illness, I'm just thinking of like people I know who have gotten diagnosed with diabetes or cancer. You would never have to wait for days in the ER mm-hmm. with a diagnosis like that. But if you are suicidal, you might have to wait for days in the ER here. Mm-hmm. I mean, why is that okay?
Right.
You know, I mean, so access to treatment, until really it becomes a crisis, it can become a life or death kind of thing. We think that is unacceptable. And we advocate for community funding and, you know, as often as possible, keeping people in their communities, getting mm-hmm. treatment in your community, mm-hmm. like you would for any other illness. And in terms of what Mike was saying about his brother, it's, we find a lot of times people with mental illness are isolated.
Yes.
You know, in treatment and outside of treatment. And the media, you know, people sometimes say, oh, well, you know, the problem is because they closed down all these mental institutions. Mm. The solution is never to institutionalize people on a mass scale. That right. is, it's just such an
insane.
Yeah. It's such an uneducated way of thinking that all of our problems are because we had closed institutions down. Right. The problems were that when they were closed down, people were supposed to get community treatment, and that yes. follow-up never happened.
That's absolutely true. And in addition to that, and he did raise the issue of police, and of course, being who I am, I just can't let that just slide by. And I know he's referring to what we're all seeing across the country, and this week it's Baltimore, next week it'll be a different community. But the reality is that we do have a culture whereby we have accepted it as part of doing business when the police shoot unarmed people in our community. And what's becoming clear is that the people who are most impacted are people who are African-American, Latino, low-income, people with mental health issues, because those are the people most likely to be on the street, most likely to be people that will interact in the police with the police in some way, shape, or form. And so as a society, we have to think about, what is the job of police? And do we really think it makes sense to have police being first responders for people with mental health issues? I thought it was ludicrous that the DOJ thought that was a good thing, but I know NAMI has a position on that as well.
We don't think it's fair to put the police in that position either. And one of the things that NAMI supports, and some of our county affiliates actually pay for these trainings, are crisis intervention team training, mm-hmm. where officers go, and a lot of times they will work with people and hear from them directly who have had psychotic breaks mm-hmm. and said, okay, here's what was going through my mind. Here's what happened.
Right.
And fortunately, we have had a really good reception, you know, even in here, basically mostly in Oregon, where people, they want to learn. They mm-hmm. want to know, you know, what can they do? And how can they make things better?
One of the things that's scary here, though, is where in Portland, is that people volunteer for that training, for crisis intervention training. And I would think that you wouldn't want just anybody to volunteer. You would want a special kind of person to be trained and to respond to those kind of calls. We've got callers backed up, so I'm not going to make you answer that. Yes, I am, because my engineer's not there, so I'll make you answer that now. He's probably going to get our other guests.
Yep.
And so we are really challenged by, that question, right? What is the, how do you pick the right officers and give them the right training if, in fact, they are going to be responding to mental health calls?
Well, I think personally everyone should be trained, because anyone could respond to a mental health call. And I try to explain to people, you know, there are a lot of stereotypes about mental illness. People are not going to see, you know, most of us walking down the street and be able to say that person has a mental illness. I was explaining to someone, when you see someone on the street talking to themselves, that is the equivalent of someone in stage four cancer never having gotten treatment. I mean, that usually represents decades of you know, untreated illness. So I would, ideally, I would like everyone to be trained and, you know, to connect and have compassion and be able to recognize that, you know, this person, it's, you know, that it's not necessarily a scary situation, but that most times a person is very scared themselves. I have a cousin with schizophrenia, and he wasn't diagnosed until he was in his late 20s. Mm-hmm. And it can be very scary if you are hearing something or seeing something. Just because no one else can see it doesn't mean
it's not real to you.
Exactly.
Right. Right. Well, welcome. Thank you for joining us. We have finally in the studio. I tell you, today has been a traffic day, but we are so glad that David Dowell has joined us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi.
It's great to have you here. Hope you've been listening on your way in.
Actually, I didn't know what was going on. I was stuck in traffic, and then I got here, and I was outside for about 10, 15 minutes.
Oh, no.
Darn.
Well, you're here now, and we are glad to have you here. I just want to check and make sure. Can you hear through your headphones?
Yeah, I hear you great.
Okay, good. And so I shared with our listening audience your bio that you sent me, which still touches me. Every time I read it, it's like gives me goosebumps. And so I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank you for being part of NAMI Walk and all your long years of history working with NAMI. And so we're going to go back to the phone line, give you a minute, get the call, and then we'll come back and ask you some more specific questions, okay?
Cool. Let me settle in here.
Yeah, let you settle. Would you like some Dave's Killer Bread?
Never touch this stuff.
Hello, Patty. Welcome to K-Boo. Good morning.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you just fine. We're just laughing too loud. We'll try to hold it down.
It's emotional for me because this hits very close to home, and it's a real traumatic thing for me. I have major depression, and I first had it when I was in high school, and I was hospitalized a couple of times. I was suicidal a few times, and a couple of times even after high school, I was suicidal. And I this is in California, and I've had police come and have to take me to the hospital, and it's always been the way it was supposed to be done. Mm-hmm. And then in 2000, I moved to Arizona, and my entire life changed. First of all, I never knew I was so proactive in my mental health. It's like, okay, I have this thing, I need to manage it. Mm-hmm. Because I can't afford to get sick, because once I'm too sick, then I can't get myself out of it.
Right.
So I had a lot of tools that I didn't realize until I moved to Arizona, and right away I went and got a doctor so that they know what I'm like when I'm well, so they know what I'm like when I'm not well. You know, I did all the right things, went to a support group, and what I found was, I mean, just my life just turned upside down. I had an issue with the police, and then because I admitted that, well, actually it was a domestic violence situation where I was taken in instead of my boyfriend. But when I was in there and filled out the paperwork, I said, yes, I, because I've never been ashamed of it. I went back to college at 30 in psychology. I worked in a lab in psychiatry. So I'm well versed in all of this, and I have always been pro-treatment. I mean, I respect people who don't want to take the medications or whatever, but you have to do something to manage it.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, after this jail thing, they used that against me. I mean, they were abusive and slammed my head down on the bed, and then said, oh, she was banging her head on the bed.
When you were in jail?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And this was one night I came out of there black and blue. I didn't know where I was. I mean, and now I have post-traumatic stress from that. I'm just terrified of police. Now, what's really bizarre is in the last 4 years, two different times in a place in Arizona. My sister called for a welfare check, which I was like, you know, never call the police with me because I have issues with them. That's part of my PTSD.
Right.
She called them anyways. They come in three lit up sheriff's cars right to my place. I mean, just adding attention to it. And I just hid and refused to answer the door. And they tortured me, basically. Like, they just would not go away. They're outside laughing. At one point, they went over to the neighbors, and these are gossiping neighbors, and I came out to say, don't even listen to them. And that's when they tackled me to the ground, put my hands behind my back, cuffed me. I had no shoes, no ID. They took me 60 miles away. Now, I'm a person who always has a doctor, always takes my medication. I am pro-treatment.
Yes, ma'am. And I'm so sorry. We are really going to have to move on.
Okay, can I say one other thing?
If you can be brief, yes.
I will be very brief. The problem with that is that they've used those words, a danger to self and others, against me because I protested, because I wasn't trying to kill myself, and
right.
Then that's on my record. And once you go in, there are no rules. You can have all the policies in the world. They do whatever they want. They force you to be tested.
Well, ma'am, I want to again thank you for sharing your story. It sounds traumatic, painful. It sounds like you're continuing to suffer the consequences of those interactions with the police. But please forgive me for having to move on. We've got callers stacked up. And are you connected?
Because of the myth that mentally ill people are more dangerous, which is a lie.
That's absolutely true. Thank you for your call. Appreciate you. Have a great day. And so, Dave, I want to appreciate you for being in the studio. I think you are a brave man because even before the incident in 2013, you were very articulate about sharing your story about your criminal convictions, the fact that you had to rebuild your life when you came out. And so I want to appreciate the fact that you have been a role model for many people. And I know that might be hard for you. Is that a hard thing to hear?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, those first few years from 2001 in prison until 2005 when I got out, and all the years since have been like a dream come true or whatever. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's just like living in heaven. And you know, so the hard part, I mean, I worked really hard in those early days, and I just did what was natural, what came natural. People wanted to hear my story, so I told it. Mm-hmm. And the only way I can do that is to tell the truth. And,
right.
And so I told people, warts and all, my story. And now I got a brand new hole in me, and I'm trying to seal that up, I'm trying to heal that.
Mm. You want to talk a bit about that brand new hole?
Well, yeah, I didn't, you know, I've always known I was depressed. I took medication for that back, you know, starting in 2001. It changed my life. It was a miracle. I started going to school for drafting and in prison, and learned computers and drafting. It was exciting to me, and I was passionate about it. The first time in my life I ever got passionate about anything, really. And, you know, I kind of had such great success. Eventually, after learning the drafting and applying that to baked goods, it was just an amazing success. And then I worked my butt off for many years, several years at least. And, you know, when that started, when I didn't have to work as hard anymore, mm-hmm. it just seemed like other things, you know, the balance, the things I balanced my work with instead of something healthy, I started drinking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's certainly a good chance that drinking was, you know, to, you know, self-medicate.
Mm-hmm.
Self-medicate. And so eventually I tried to quit drinking several times. I had quit drinking for a few weeks before the incident. And I had my first experience with mania that I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the mania, it was like a spiritual experience for a long time. Then all of a sudden that day happened. And it got out of control. And so you know, the result was just doesn't make any sense, honestly. But it was terrible, and it unfortunately I felt like I had let everybody down. Mm-hmm. And but it was, you know, I finally realized that, hey, look, you know, it happened, and maybe there's a reason for it. So the hole in me right now is getting better.
It's getting better.
It's healing.
And so from 2013 to now, what are you doing to help heal that hole?
Well, just having the awareness of the fact that I can have such a thing happen helps. I take medication for bipolar now, not just, you know, I get a lamotrigine for the mania side. Mm-hmm. I get my sleep, and I have to use I have to use medication to do that because I'm just so at night. So the medication I use for that is called Seroquel, and it's a very old drug. But it works very well as long as you're not trying to do something on it. It's just, so if you and your old lady are going to have some fun, don't take that.
Don't take that ahead of time.
She gets really mad at me when I do that.
And so, Dave, I'm curious.
And a few other things, too.
And a few other things. And so I'm curious. I know that most of us saw the news story about you driving and you being arrested and the craziness that happened that night. But what you said to me was, we don't know the story.
That's true. And, you know, honestly, I don't know all the story. I certainly
That is pretty honest. I appreciate that.
I wasn't all there.
Right.
And but I can tell you that things that were written down about it weren't true. Mm. And they were, some things were certainly not presented as they were. Mm. So.
And do you feel that that media attention, did that help you to seek more help, or has that just had the opposite effect?
It was devastating. It was just like more, I felt like everybody was, you know, had been let everybody down, and they were, but then I started realizing, a friend of mine told me, a good friend said, the people who know you and love you will always be the people who know you and love
That's
you.
That's right, that's
so
right.
So those people that were, haters of Dave came out, you know, they had like ammunition. So I just ignored it. I tried to ignore it, you know, and I tried, but it was hard. At first, after the incident, there was several months of just serious depression like I'd never experienced. Mm-hmm. Maybe I had experienced before, but it had been so long I forgot how it felt.
Right. Well, we're going to go back to the phone line. And if you are just joining the conversation, I want you to know that here in the studio, I have Michelle
Madison,
Wendy Sample, and David Dow. I knew I had the Michelle part. I just couldn't remember what the last part was.
Okay,
we're going to go back to the phone line. James. Good morning, James. Welcome to K-Boo. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for bringing up this issue. I spent a good portion of my life after high school working with folks with mental disabilities, and you realize that it's you know, what somebody was talking about, how, you know, well, there's a problem that we closed up all the institutions, but it seems like that's the kind of take that we have in society, that if something is undesirable, then we should just keep it as far from our view as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, Kate, yesterday they had this really good, comparison. I can't remember whose show it was, but they were talking about how there's how social justice and eco-justice can come together on the intersection of discarded people and discarded land. And when you start looking at it, that the idea of racism or sexism, it's not so much the degradation of a particular race or a particular gender, or, I mean, in this case, a particular type of people, but it's an elevation also of those who are considered more worthy and more deserving of time and resources.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see how so many states have taken to like you take a Willowbrook, for example, their institution was built in Staten Island. That institution was built on a garbage dump, and people talked about how people took their garbage to Staten Island, so why should people be any different?
Mm-hmm.
And you hear that comparison so often. And when you really sit down to think about it, I mean, we treat black folks like they're garbage. We treat homeless people like they're garbage. We treat transgendered, anybody who doesn't fit the mold of what is considered right or worthy within the context of a imperialist colonial, you know, imperious colony mindset. We do away with it. There's no sense in trying to waste time and resources on something that they deem unworthy.
It's absolutely true. Thank you so much. I appreciate you calling us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for bringing this up. People with mental health issues, they deserve just as much of our attention. They are just as much. They are people just like you and I. They think differently. They have different strengths. They shouldn't be degraded because of their weaknesses.
And we should realize that we all are temporarily mentally healthy.
Yeah, it's
right?
True.
It's
totally true.
It's temporary, right. Thank you so much. Yeah. Appreciate the call. Have a great day.
You're very welcome.
And so I want to remind our listeners that the NAMI Walk, the 13th annual NAMI Walk, will take place Sunday, May 17th. We will meet at Vera Katz East Bank Espionage Festival area in Portland. For more information, you can contact Michelle Madison, and you can go to NAMI, NAMIOR.org. And visit their website for additional information.
And also donation. You can't walk.
Yes.
Thank you, Dave.
If you can't, I didn't say it, and of course we don't like promote, you know, like money for anything other than cable.
Oh, really?
But I think that, you know, you raise a good point. Clearly, there's a lot that people can do to support people with mental health issues in our community. What I love about the NAMI Walk is that you don't have to run, right? Because most of the time it's a run for something, right? So you can walk, you can run, you can.
It's not a race.
Just be there. Exactly. Mm. It's not a race. I love that. And so I think we should go back to the phone line. Hello, Sunny. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Joanne. Always such good shows, important shows. It's nice to have all your folks there.
Well, thank you, Sunny.
Bringing the subject to us. Thank you. You know, what I hear in the calls, particularly with James' calls, is that many of us who are listening out here, we want a more healing society.
Yes.
We think that there's a lot of mental illness such as cruelty, classism, racism, neglect, blah, blah, blah. I also wanted to say the woman who called in and was talking about her ordeal, I think that's such an important story to bring forward. This is happening.
Yes.
And I want her to know, if she's still listening, I respect her. I respect her. I'm part of Heart Nation. We respect her. We want everything to go better for her, and we are hearing her.
Yes.
And we feel that sort of thing, which happens too much, is totally unacceptable. Talk about treating a people, supposedly bringing them to health. Oh, my gosh, the hypocrisy. Well, anyway, I was going to say to the people assembled, I'm in contact with a group of people that were trying to get an increase, well, not an increase, a tax on junk food to create social centers in every city where people can come in, interact, have opportunity to sit down, have a bowl of soup, exercise, dance, art. Parents can have respite and contact and support so that we can send some nurturance towards all individuals into the society so that we can start working on it at the base. And would any of them perhaps support that kind of effort publicly where we start building society from the bottom up to reduce the stress upon people, the isolation? And I do believe the stress that a woman endures in pregnancy does, I think it's been proven, has it not, that it has an impact upon her child's mental health as they go on through life.
Absolutely true. I will ask that question. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
Your call, Sunny. We
You're
really
welcome.
Appreciate it. Have a great
Bye-bye.
Day. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
So think that's a good idea? Junk food tax to build centers across the state?
don't know. That's a new one to me. I need to think about that.
All right.
Haven't heard of that. I would like to mention, though, here in the Portland area, we do have a couple of community places that have drop-in activities for people living with severe and persistent mental illness, and that's Folk Time. You can go to their website at folktime.org, and also North Star Clubhouse, and that is northstar.org, and North Star also helps with job placement.
That's good to know. And clearly we need many, many, many more support systems for folks who are suffering from mental health issues. And so are you planning to participate in the walk?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm on Michelle's team. Michelle Madison. Yeah, and so is my fiance, Michelle.
Wonderful. And how many years have you participated in the walk?
What, 4 years?
4 years.
Yeah. 4 years?
I think I missed one because I was in treatment or something.
Had a team there that year. So.
That's right. Yeah. Right, but he got his team there. Like that. Right, you didn't make it, but you got your team there. And what are you most looking forward to this year?
Well, I'm looking forward to get started with my, you know, what I envision myself being a part of. Certainly, NAMI has always been top of mind. But I'm really into, you know, telling my story, the real deal, so that other people can benefit from it. You know, if I can do this, and I've done it a few times.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You're getting good at this.
Yes. I'm the comeback kid now, and that's what it's all about. I mean, it's not about me, but, you know, I have to have my game together in order to be helpful to others. So.
Right.
It's extremely helpful. I can just say thank you, Dave, for being so open over the years, because there are so many people that get hope, you know, because you were able to be successful and by being open. And Dave could have easily just not talked about this ever.
And could have easily after.
Yeah, just hidden away.
Well, at first, that's what it seemed like I was going to have to do. And but then like I said, I didn't think I had a reason at first. I didn't know that. But now I see that it's just another part of the story.
And, yes.
You know, and it's so ugly, but it can be beautiful. So.
Yes. Well, and isn't that like life, right?
Yeah.
You know, it can be ugly sometimes, but we try to make it as beautiful as possible. We're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Sean. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. The focus of my call, I'd like to be defending the large state mental hospitals. When I was 15, I spent 4 months in an excellent adolescent psychiatric hospital, and it changed my life. Are we to believe that the 50 years of deinstitutionalization have just happened by accident? I mean, just how naive do we have to be? The so-called community mental health clinics have been systematically underfunded. It hasn't been an accident.
Yes.
So I'd just like to challenge that notion, because what this society does is it practices euthanasia by neglect on poor people.
Yes.
And it does that with the poor mentally ill, the people that wind up in the criminal justice system, poor people that wind up in our nursing homes.
Yes.
It's a way to disappear people.
Yes.
It hasn't been an accident. We need to get the state mental hospitals back, but improve them dramatically. Because if people's a hierarchy of needs aren't met, they can't even begin to focus on their emotional problems. And this is well known. This isn't an accident. So that's the focus of my call today. Thank you.
Thank you. Really appreciate you calling. And I don't think any of us think that a well-functioning state hospital in and of itself is a bad thing. But when these state hospitals were closed with the promise of community mental health treatment, that is the promise that was never realized. And we have elected people, we have the legislature meeting right now, and I bet you money that expanding mental health beds and treatment is not on the agenda. It just simply isn't. And I guess I should ask, because I don't know the answer to this, is it better now that healthcare reform has happened? Are people better able to access mental health services today than they were prior to healthcare reform?
I could say in Oregon, I think there's good news and bad news. The good news is that a lot of chronically uninsured people are insured now because we've accepted the Medicaid dollars. I've talked to colleagues around the country whose states have not accepted those, and they said, you were so lucky that your government said yes. On the other hand, you have this flood of people who are now able to afford or at least seek treatment. They have insurance, and the waits are terrible. We I have a friend who had to wait 4 months just to get in for an initial mental health appointment. In the meantime, he went into crisis, ended up at, you know, at the urgent walk-in clinic because he was having suicidal thoughts.
Right.
You know, and he ended up being okay, but you just wonder how many people can't wait. In 4 months, can you imagine if you had, you know, a cancer diagnosis, right? Would you wait 4 months? No, yeah. It's just, right. Again, it's not as socially acceptable, even though it's common, it's not as talked about. And again, people like, you know, like Dave and Wendy sharing your stories, mm-hmm. making that more common, making like, hey, this is okay, this happens to people, this mm-hmm. is, you know. And when the person was talking about people dying, frankly, people living with mental illness die an average of 25 years earlier than the rest of the population. If that was any other group, that would be an outrage. And right. It is an outrage, and it's right. usually from treatable medical conditions.
Right. If caught early, right? Back to the phone line. Good morning, Eric. Welcome to KBOO.
Yeah, I need to address a problem with misdiagnosis. I was diagnosed with a borderline personality disorder pre-95. It was corrected in 2008 when I had an intense neuropsych evaluation that discovered I have Asperger's syndrome.
Mm.
And that, now I'm in the process of going back and correcting all those misdiagnoses, because borderline personality disorder is a death knell for a job or anything.
Right. Thank you. Appreciate your call. Have a good day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We have about 10 minutes left in the program, and so I want to make sure. Wendy, how is your sister?
She's all right. Right now we're trying to get her at 62 on a wait list for subsidized housing. You know, due to her condition, she won't, you know, do that readily. So, and unfortunately, her advocate just got another job.
No.
So it will be a, you know, period of time of trying to find someone else that can work with her mm-hmm. and that she will trust. Trust is a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking towards that. But I did want to mention another thing NAMI does very, very well is they have a group of people that talk about in your own voice.
Mm.
And they can go into companies or meetings or, you know, wherever people would like to listen.
Schools.
Because schools, big one, yeah. And talk about their story and what happened, and they look normal, they talk normal. It's great to have someone at, you know, a club that, you know, hasn't discussed this kind of issue.
And normal is a setting on a dryer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. You don't want to be too normal. Those kids won't relate.
That's right. That's absolutely true.
Well, you can wear some socks like Joanne has on.
Right.
Are those socks?
Never mind, listening audience. Never mind. And so one thing I wanted to say before we wrap up this program is, I don't know if you guys saw, OPB did a special over the weekend on the civil rights movement here in Portland. And then they had an extra hour of a panel discussion. Former Senator Avell Gordley was part of that panel discussion, and I so appreciated her reminding people that we are all in need of mental health care, because we have all either been raised and live in a white supremacist society or have been victimized by racism throughout our lifetime. And so there's no one that actually doesn't fall under the need for mental health treatment and support just by living in the United States of America.
Can I say something really quick?
Yes, please.
That is what it's all about right there. It's like people, I think, I wouldn't say it's more black people, I just don't know, but people don't want to admit weakness like that.
Yes.
And it, you know, that's what happened to me. It took me years to finally put in that kite to psych services in prison,
mm-hmm.
and it changed my life. People just need to understand, if you're suffering, mm-hmm. just do it. Who cares what anybody thinks?
Amen
right.
to that.
Amen is right.
That's an excellent. We're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Linda. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO. Could you please be short, sweet, to the point? Because we're almost out of time.
Okay, Good morning.
Good morning.
I work for an agency who did group homes for developmentally disabled. That was their main focus, but they also did mental health houses. And the difference in the treatment was astounding. Developmentally disabled people were told that this is your home, you have rights, and on the side of the mental health, it was you need to earn your thing.
Oh.
And this is not, you're to progress from this home. So there was no security. And there was always fear. It was like the system blames people that are mentally ill for their mental illness, and they can do better, and if you do better, we'll give you these rights.
Yes.
We'll give you these rewards. It was astonishing.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Are you still working there?
I know. I'm still working with developmentally disabled folks, but not mental health people. But the difference was just astonishing.
Wow, that is astonishing. Thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Systemic,
right? And so, I mean, clearly it's a problem that's been around for a long, long time. When the DOJ came to town and they actually investigated our mental health system and found it extremely lacking, what hasn't happened is any kind of mandate about how to fix what's broken, right? So that's a challenge. We got a couple of more callers on the line. Hello, Kenneth. Good morning. Welcome to K-Book. Can you please be short, sweet, and to the point?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Is that David Dahl you have on this call?
Yes, it is. That's the man.
Oh, well, hello, David. We don't know each other, but we happen to be on the yard about the same time, and then I see your name on all the bread wrappers today.
Hey, how's it going?
But good job, and kudos to you. And what I want to say about the mental health thing is I couldn't get a diagnosis for PTSD and all the other things that have come along with that after my 35 or 40 years of legal abuse syndrome. But I find that balance in a book called Overcoming the Devastation of Legal Abuse Syndrome, written by Dr. Karen Huffer, and her book was co-signed with 100 or more different psychologists around the United States. But are you familiar with the Murphy Bill? I don't know where that ended up, but I learned about the Murphy Bill from a lady that's involved in the health advocate process here with her own son and others. And she introduced me to the Murphy Bill that was on Congress, and that was kind of like she explained to me that a cop can come down the Springwater Corridor bike path, and if anybody that looks loopy, he can basket them up and have them shipped to the state hospital for evaluation. And then there was this new prison in Cave Junction, which the folks didn't want to have a new prison in Cave Junction, so now they've changed this idea for it being a prison to be another state hospital with about 3,500 beds to fill when they come around here on the bike path and grab us all up for looking loopy and homeless.
Well, you know, I need to follow up on that because neither of these are issues that I've heard about in the past, but it certainly sounds like something that's worth us doing some further looking into. I appreciate the call. If you'd be kind enough to leave your number with my engineer, I will call you later and try to get more details about that.
Okay, thank
you so much for your call. We are getting minus on minutes, and so I want to give each of you an opportunity to share some closing thoughts with us. And Wendy, I'll start with you, if that's okay. I am so thrilled that you are here. I am so happy that NAMI is going to be taking place on Sunday, May 17th, the NAMI Walk. And so, Wendy, any final words?
You bet. Join my team or Michelle's or anyone else's.
Little competition happening.
But we would just invite everybody out again. There's no cost to the walk. So come one, come all.
You don't have to physically walk. You can just come hang out, listen to music. But it's making a statement that this is important, that this matters, that we matter. We've been out there 13 years. Last year, we had 4,000 people. Oregonian will not cover this event.
Well, they never cover anything good now. And Dave, for you, I just again want to thank you for being here. I know that you don't do a lot of public speaking, but the fact that you agreed to be here just warms my heart. Any last words?
Yeah, two things. I want to put in a plug for DDA. There's 12-step programs are everywhere, but Dual Diagnosis Anonymous is absolutely phenomenal.
It's a great
because
group.
People are, you go there, for me, it's just that fits like a glove. Could you go in there and people talk, tell your story over and over again. Everybody in the circle is telling their story.
Right.
It's phenomenal for someone who has addiction and mental illness issues, which those two things go hand in hand.
Yes, they do.
When you're on drugs, you're mentally ill anyway.
So get the second one out.
One more thing. one more thing, and that's I'm making a, we're almost done with a video of my life story, including the warts and all stuff. So that'll be, please watch my Facebook pages, and it'll be there.
And it will be coming up. I am Joanne Hardesty. This has been Voices from the Edge. Next week, I will have Greg Pallas. He will be here to help us kick off our membership drive. Thank you so much for listening. See you next week, same time, same place, same station. Have a great day.
Woohoo! Well,
thanks.
Heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that glitter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on, get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. It is 9 o'clock, and on your Thursday morning, we hope you'll stay with us for Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia in 1 hour from now at 10 with headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints today, join us for workers protesting the hedge fund buyout of the American Apparel in Los Angeles. Also, the Flashpoints multi-part series, The Battle for Public Education in the 21st Century, continues, and more on rising opposition to testing in the U.S. public schools. And at 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman speaks with Viet Thanh Nguyen about Sympathizer, his spy novel examining the legacy of Vietnam. And later in the hour, we'll hear a little poetry and a look at the new film Jimmy Hall, Jimmy's Hall, that is, about political activist Jimmy's